please be seated. All right, we have one case on our 10:30 docket, Glenn versus Pack. If the clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Santo Vargas will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Roger Yell will argue for the appellate.
All right, thank you. Mr. Vargas.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justice. Justice Livingston, Justice Meyer, Justice McCoy, first of all, let me thank you for allowing us to present oral argument on this case this morning, and thank you all very much for your time. Can I please get a two-minute warning? What's the 15 minutes are up? May it please the court. Justice of the court, the reason we're here today is because at trial, the trial of Mr. Pack versus Mr. Terry Glenn, Mrs. Monica Glenn, there were several errors that occurred. And the cumulative effect of those errors caused my clients, Terry Glenn and Monica Glenn, not to receive a fair trial. Justices, they did not receive a fair trial, and I'm here to point out why. First of all, I'd like to start out talking to the court about the one satisfaction rule. And we believe one of the main errors that occurred at trial is that the trial court failed to apply the one satisfaction rule even whenever it was requested by counsel for Mr. and Mrs. Glenn. The main problem that occurred here, Justices, is that Mr. Pack had two causes of action that he was claiming that were allowed to go forward in the jury charge. Those two causes of action were breach of contract and tortious interference with existing contract. The problem with that is that there was only one alleged injury. The alleged injury that Mr. Pack was complaining of is that he was not able to sell his home. And that's the most important thing to remember here. Now, he could have sold his house theoretically to Mr. Glenn, my client, or he could have sold his house to potential subsequent purchasers, which would have been Mr. Cecil and Stephanie Funk. But he would not have been able to sell it to both. And that's the only alleged injury that we're dealing with. Essentially, what happened at trial, Justices, is that he received a double recovery for the same injury. What one important thing to remember here is that prior to my client's involvement
You wouldn't be entitled to a new trial if you're correct. We could reform the damages to reflect, the larger amount, correct? Because your argument is, well, he got 50 for the loss of the sale of the house, and then he got some more money involving the Funks for the loss of the sale of the house on the tortious interference claim, but he shouldn't get both. We could reform the judgment just to reflect the larger amount, correct?
Essentially, that's correct, Justice McCoy, but he got the 50 plus he also got attorney's fees, which he wouldn't have been entitled to with a tortious interference claim. So it either would have been the tortious interference claim, the damages that correspond to that, or the breach of contract and damages that respond.
So you're suggesting we would remand it for an election of damages?
On that particular point of error, that's correct, Justice.
Okay.
But essentially, the way the rule works, or unless the court wants to move on, is that whenever there is one alleged injury, the prevailing party has to elect a remedy after the verdict, but before the judgment is rendered. If he fails to elect a remedy, then essentially what has to happen is that the trial court has to make that election for him, and that election is simple to make. It's just whichever is the greater of the two recoveries. And that's what failed to happen, despite the fact that we made a motion for a new trial on that specific point, and the judge denied it.
Well, then going back to my question, are you suggesting that if we bought your argument, we would render judgment then based on the larger damage of the 50 plus the attorney's fees, or the damages to be awarded for the failure of the Funk sale?
Or remand it for that election, Justice McCoy.
Okay.
Moving on from the one satisfaction rule, we also feel that the court erred by interpreting the law to allow the actions of Mr. Glenn's previous attorney to be imputed to himself and also to Mrs. Glenn. And essentially what happened there is that Mr. Glenn had a previous attorney at the trial of this, during the trial proceedings of this cause. That attorney's name was Daryl Washington. That attorney stopped representing him about midway through the litigation, but before the case ever got to trial. And what happened early on in the litigation there is that Mr. Washington, after the sale of the house fell through initially, Mr. Washington took steps to make sure that the house wasn't sold because he was trying to secure the house from my client and felt that my client was still able to enforce the contract. He filed a list pendants. There was a motion that was filed by opposing counsel to remove the list pendants. That was denied. There was also a letter that was sent by Mr. Washington, and that letter referenced the list pendants and also made reference to a quote-unquote constructive lien. Constructive lien does not exist in Texas. It's not even a legal fiction in Texas. It's just something that doesn't exist, period.
So really, that allegation would have no bearing on what happened. Is that correct? In other words, the only thing that was really in place was the notice of list pendants.
That's correct, Justice.
So that couldn't have very well prevented the sale, something that's imaginary.
It couldn't have prevented the sale, and the only evidence as to why Mr. and Mrs. Funk withdrew from the contract shows that they withdrew because of the list pendants that was filed, which was proper, and that was, you know, that was upheld in a prior proceeding before we even got to trial. But if you look at tab J to the appellant's brief, there's a letter.
Do we look at that from the standpoint of a lawyer? A lawyer knows that there is no such thing as a constructive lien, unless maybe you want to call a Liz Pendens a constructive lien. Or do we look at it from the standpoint of the prospective buyers who wouldn't know a constructive lien from deep left field? So,
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
You said it couldn't have prevented the sale.
That's correct.
Because there is no such thing. And what I'm saying is, well, do we look at that from the perspective of a lawyer who knows there is no such thing, or do we look at it from the standpoint of a prospective home buyer who wouldn't know if there is such a thing as a constructive lien in Texas?
Well, I think in this particular case, Justice, you would have to look at it through both, because counsel for the Funks, who sent the letter saying that it was actually the list pendants that caused him to withdraw, would have counseled them with respect to the letter that was sent by Mr. Glenn's previous attorney. And they were represented by that counsel, and they would have received legal counsel on that. But essentially here, the evidence is uncontroverted at trial that Mr. Glenn didn't have any idea what was going on with respect to his previous counsel. There was no controverting facts on that particular issue. The only thing that Mr. Glenn testified to at trial with respect to his interaction with Mr. Washington was that he asked Mr. Washington to help him enforce the sale of the home. The evidence showed that he didn't know what a constructive lien was, that he never requested the list pendants. The evidence also showed that he didn't even know what a list pendants was. He thought it was something that was French, for lack of a better term, and that's what he testified to at trial. And he just didn't know what was going on. The testimony is also uncontroverted that Monica Glenn didn't have any clue that Mr. Washington was even doing anything for Mr. Glenn, or for her, for that matter. She never met Mr. Washington. She never had a conversation with Mr. Washington. The trial court judge assumed, and it's in the record, and it's cited in the brief, that there was a fee agreement between Mrs. Glenn, between Mr. Glenn, and between Mr. Washington. In fact, there was no fee agreement between my clients and their previous attorney.
Well, of course, you're going for the fact that they weren't, the lawyer wasn't the client's agent, but clearly the lawyer is authorized to act on behalf of the agent. Otherwise, the lawyer has no authority to act.
That's correct. The lawyer does have authority to act on behalf of the...
So if you have authority to act on behalf of the principal, you're the agent.
But whenever, and I cited several cases relating to Rule 13 of the Texas Civil Rules of Procedure, in order for the acts of an attorney to be imputed to the client, there has to be some, you have to overcome a presumption of good faith. In other words, if a lawyer does something that is wrong in representing his client, that lawyer's actions cannot be imputed then to his client unless it's shown that there was not good faith on the part of the client. And if you cannot overcome that presumption, then you can't impute the lawyer's acts to the client. And the testimony in this particular case, Justice, shows that my client, Mr. Glenn, didn't have a clue what his client or what his attorney was doing. He just wanted the house, and that's all he hired him to do.
But of course, Rule 13 has to do with sanctions, and I didn't observe any cases you cited that said a lawyer is not the agent of his client.
And we didn't find any cases particularly on point on that specific issue, Justice. But the most analogous cases that we could find were with Rule 13. And we believe that those are analogous here because essentially what's going on is that you have a client that hired an attorney to enforce a contract, but you don't have a client that requested an attorney just to file a constructive lien or even file a list pendants for that matter. And so we don't feel that in this particular case those actions of the client should be imputed to them. And especially with respect, even more so with respect to Monica Glenn, because she didn't even have any interaction with Mr. Washington and had never even spoken to him or met him. In the next issue, Justices, and I've already sort of spoken about this, it's really with respect to Monica Glenn. There's no way that you know, there's no evidence presented at trial that showed that she should have even been included in the there's any damages that should have been assessed against her because her testimony was truly uncontroverted, that she just didn't have any idea what was going on. Even with respect to the sale of the purchase of the property, she testified that Mr. Glenn was the one that handled everything.
Was her name on the contracts? And the reason I'm asking that is, therefore, Mr. Glenn and Mrs. Glenn had the same reason to hire the lawyer who then was acting on their behalf because they were both on the contracts. If they were, I don't know that.
They were both on the contract, Justice. However,
but
the testimony is uncontroverted. And opposing counsel could have called the prior attorney, Darryl Washington, as a witness to question him about some of these issues to controvert Mr. Glenn and Mrs. Glenn, but he didn't. The only evidence presented at trial was that Mrs. Glenn didn't have anything to do with Mr. Washington and never spoke to him or never met him.
But if we follow that to its logical conclusion, then if he prevailed, he would have only prevailed on behalf of Mr. Glenn, and Mrs. Glenn would have been hung out to dry because Mr. Washington wasn't representing her. I mean, that dog doesn't hunt very well, do you think?
I'm sorry, Justice.
If Lawyer Washington had prevailed and he was only representing Mr. Glenn, then Mrs. Glenn would be left for nothing because you could take the position, well, the lawyer wasn't representing her, even though all the pleadings list her and so forth. It was only representing Mr. Glenn. I mean, that really doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
I can see with respect to whenever you have a counterclaim issue, that might be a little bit of a stretch, Your Honor. But with respect to there just simply wasn't any evidence presented at trial with respect to Mrs. Glenn having any knowledge of what was going on. And having the lawyer's actions imputed to her when there's no knowledge that that she knows everything about this attorney, we think is just improper. We also think that going back to the tortious interference, we think that the tortious interference shouldn't have been included in the jury charge. There simply was no evidence that Mr. Glenn or Mrs. Glenn tortiously interfered. The list pendants was upheld in a prior proceeding. The only evidence presented at trial with respect to the Funk's withdrawal from the contract, again, was their letter from their attorney that said that they withdrew because of the list pendants, not the constructive lien. With respect to the earnest money, if you look at the contract, and it's tab G, section 18, the contract specifically requires that Mr. Pack requested the earnest money be released to him in order for that damage to be awarded by the jury. That never happened. There was no evidence presented that Mr. Pack requested the earnest money to be released to him, so we don't think it was proper for the jury to award those damages on the contract just because there was no evidence presented, and the contract didn't allow it based on the evidence that was presented.
But the jury was in, if we go back to election of remedies, of course, if you go with your breach of contract remedy, the jury was entitled to award damages based on the breach of contract, which under the terms of the contract were the $50,000. So you're kind of going with a procedural nicety about, well, there wasn't a formal demand made. But if the jury awarded $50,000 because that was the terms of the contract, if there was a breach, what's the error?
Well, we believe that there was no evidence presented that based on why they presented those why they awarded those damages, there was no evidence presented that would support that damage finding, Judge.
So sort of what you're saying is, I think, that the jury's job was to determine whether it was a breach of contract, and whether you awarded the liquidated damages allotted in the contract was a question of law and not for the jury, because the damages are set out in the contract. They aren't a matter of discretion, basically, or proof once you've proved up the contract. Is that? But regardless of that, it's still $50,000.
Again, I'm not sure that I'm separating it with respect to a question of law for the judge to decide on the procedural standpoint. Our position is that there was no evidence presented at trial to support the damage finding, because there was no evidence presented that procedure with respect to the liquidated damages was ever followed by Mr. Pack.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vargas. Mr. Yale.
Justices, counsel, with regard to the tort issue, was there a tort when there was a constructive lien language in the letter? There was. And was the evidence so scant as counsel has stated? No. Lisa DeLeon, Robert DeLeon, the brokers on the matter, both testified the constructive lien affected the sale of the property, as did Robert Pack. They said the imposition of the constructive lien negatively affected the sale of the property to the Funks, the subsequent buyers.
How could there be a problem or a cause of termination of the contract if we've already agreed or established that there is no such thing as a constructive lien under the theories presented in this case?
Justice Livingston, that is because it creates a cloud on the title. Once
I could say, I'm going to file a lien of hocus pocus on your property, and that creates a cloud on your title?
It does under essentially the analogous section of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Chapter 12, and there is a particular definition in the jury charge with regard to what constitutes a fraudulent filing. And the court will note that the document that states we are asking for the imposition of a constructive lien was filed in the real property records of Denton County. And I believe it's contained in certainly within the record, but also within a tab of the appellant's brief.
Well, maybe a better argument. Yeah, I'm not, you know.
All help is welcome.
Words in your mouth, but here, try these. Would be that you could tortiously interfere with the contract with a threatening letter, regardless of whether or not such a thing exists, I would think.
And that, too, is my point, Your Honor, in that in this state of litigious society, when there is a pending action happening and something is cause for a potential concern on a house that's valued at $2.6 million, is it easier to walk away from the litigation and not purchase the house? And does that constitute a tort?
Well, nevertheless, why don't we get to damages?
Certainly.
Struggling with the damage for the sale of the house and the damages awarded for tortious interference are for the same sale of the house.
Well, they are not, sir.
Okay, will you explain that?
Certainly. We have a contract to sell the house on April 4th, 2007. That contract is terminated when Mr. Glenn sends his text messages that are within the record.
Let's assume that's correct.
All right. That entitles Mr. Pack at that moment in time to the liquidated damages of $50,000.
For the
termination of the contract.
Failure to sell his house.
Right. A liquidated. All right. Then, 17 days later, when the interference occurs, he is not allowed to sell his house. He is already entitled to that $50,000. Mm-hmm. He still has all of the equity in his house, which by calculation is $244,865, which is the sum total of the two numbers. We don't surmise to go behind and see what the jury did in deliberations, but the $194,000 was for the tortious interference on the sale to the Funks. That is a separate injury. Had we, Justice McCoy, stopped on April 1st and the Funks had not come around and we had not sold the house, we would be entitled to $50,000.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But you'd for already gotten $50,000 when you of the damage for failure to sell the house. So is there a hurricane, a tornado alert? Is there a they were damaged by the failure to sell to the Funks, okay?
17 days later.
17 days later, and?
And they're entitled to the amount of damages, which were $194,000 and change as the.
If there had been no breach of contract at all, they would have still been entitled to $194,000.
Or whatever the jury found.
Right. So seems to me that he got 50. And then he got 194, and he'd have gotten 194 regardless of the 50, because I assume there was no qualification in the question to the jury in the 194. But you know, you need to take into account that he's already gotten 50.
No, because frankly, the jury could have awarded him $244,000 on the breach of contract. That was his actual out-of-pocket loss. The fact that they contracted for a $50,000 liquidated damages cuts off that transaction at that point in time.
What is the proof of his $244,000 loss?
It's contained within the testimony, I believe, of a Miss McKinley.
Well, how do you calculate that?
How do we calculate? The number comes from the sale price of $2.6
million. Yes.
Less the payoff quote from City Mortgage, which is in the records, leaves it $244,865.
I'm lost, so okay. Maybe I
can... We take the sales price less the amount owed on the property would be his net cash to him at the end of the day.
Okay, and that was?
$244,865.
Under the contracts to the Funks?
Each contract had a similar sales price, and his payoff, which was submitted as a piece of evidence, and I don't have the exhibit number, was the $2.6 million less roughly $2.3 million.
If the sales had gone due to the Funks, he would have put in his pocket $244,000.
That's correct.
All right. And the jury awarded $194,000.
Correct.
And you're alleging that the jury believed those numbers and took the $50,000 that they had already awarded to him into account and only awarded $194,000, thinking $244,000 minus the $50,000 we've already given him is $194,000.
I believe the math is correct, and
but
I believe
that's...
We don't know that.
We don't know that. And there's no qualification in the charge about if you award damages for the Funks, you've got to take into account whatever you awarded for the breach.
Correct.
I don't know. Okay.
And I want to back up and clarify something that I can find from the record, but you probably know off the top of your head. Did the PACs ever select their remedy? In other words, under the default clause of the contract, paragraph 15, they had the right to enforce specific performance or terminate the contract?
The answer is yes. There was a letter sent by me to the title company that I believe is in evidence that said, would you please submit to Mr. and Mrs. Glenn a termination of contract notification and request that they sign it, which I believe is the election that the Her Honor is seeking.
Thank you.
Right, in that letter, was the response to your demand letter? Did you also include that the title company send the earnest money to your client?
The title company is precluded from sending the earnest money until they have the release, and they have to give a, if there is no response within 10 days, Justice Myers, then they are free to send it pursuant to the contract. But the contract has a provision that if there is a contest by, in this case, the buyer, then the title company must do nothing. And what has occurred is the title company has filed an interpleader action in county court.
And that did occur, and you ended up here then with the dispute on the $50,000 on the interpleader, as well as a separate claim for subsequent activity involving the letter that was written.
Excuse me for interrupting. If I may diverge a bit, in terms of the supersedious bond, counsel and I have agreed that it should be one action. Neither of us has taken any action in the interpleader other than a conversation with the interpleader's counsel, and that case is still pending in the county court at law number 2 in Denton County.
Well, the way that the charge is worded, it almost sounds like that you have to be here saying that as a matter of law, there was no evidence that the damages were $194,000. The damages were $244,000, and it was up to, there then had to be an election because you can't get both. I don't see how you get, I'm having trouble how you get both. You get one or the other of your damages. Because what you're really saying is there were two elements of damages, and the jury took into account that they'd already awarded 50 when they awarded the 194. But that's not really what happened, is that there was 244 as a result of the interference. By what you just told me, the difference in the selling price and the mortgage was 244, and if the sale had gone through, he'd have put $244,000 in his pocket, and there was no evidence of 194 that had to be wrong. So the jury should have awarded 50 for one scenario and 244 in the other scenario, because there was no qualification between the two damage issues.
Well, I think that I think they're two separate events, and therefore we're entitled to both damages.
But one damage. The house didn't sell, and how much was lost from it?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. There are two damages. One, when the contract is breached. That's damage one.
What if the jury had awarded 50 and 244, which it sounds like to me the evidence is what would have called upon? Would you be here arguing that he should get two elements of damages, 50 and 244?
I think the windfall would be, he would be entitled to the windfall. So the answer is, I suspect I would be, and I think every one of my brethren in Denton County would certainly be arguing that. The windfall in terms of the breach occurs because it's contractual. The $50,000 comes for liquidated damages. Liquidated damages, as the court well knows, are those that are when there is an inability to assign a valuation. So.
Mr. Yale, go ahead.
Mr. Yale, I'm reading the letter that is Exhibit J to the attached documents that apparently was an Exhibit Number 9 at trial. That's the letter from Bellinger and DeWolf, law firm in Dallas, that says that in the middle of the sentence, you have
it? I do.
Since you have been unable to remove the list pendants from the title to the property, isn't that pretty clear? And what evidence was there? In other words, the reason for the letter that came from Mr. Bellinger, who's the senior partner. failure to remove the list pendants from the title that caused his clients to terminate their contract. And I didn't see anything in that letter about any claim constructed land.
Well, there was in the letter there is not. There was testimony from Lisa DeLeon and Robert DeLeon, who were the real estate brokers, that the
For the buyers. Okay.
That said the constructive lien did cause a failure of the sale.
They're for which buyers?
They're the sellers.
They're for the buyers that were represented by Mr. Bellinger, the Bunks.
Right. They were brokers that were retained by my client, Mr. Pack, but they acted in a dual capacity, I believe. And they were the only brokers in the case. And their testimony was, I believe, in Volume 6 and Volume 7, and it's cited in my brief, that there was a problem with the constructive lien that caused the failure of the sale, as well as testimony from my client.
Well,
with
real estate agents, weren't they?
They are.
And they're not looking at the legal effects of the claim in the letter that was making reference to a constructive lien. And it's not their job to determine if that's a correct statement or not, is it?
That's correct, but we come back, Justice, to the issue of it's a cloud on the title. We're in a litigious society. Do they have another opportunity to spend their $2.6 million somewhere else?
I don't know how they testified to it without it being hearsay. Certainly not an admission against interest. It's an admission for interest. I don't know how they ever testified the reason they did anything, because it's obviously hearsay. And I take it the only people that know the real answer to the question were not called. Only the PACs know why they did not buy the house.
Do you mean the Glens?
No, the PACs. Was there tortuous interference? Why did we back out of the deal? Was it because of the
You mean the Funks?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We have several short names.
Yeah,
that are
Glenn Pack Funk. Okay. They were not called.
So the only evidence for them came from their agent, Mr. Bellinger, who's writing that the reason was the failure to remove the list pendants.
As well as the real estate agents who were also their agent.
Thank you, Mr. Yale. Mr. Vargas, you have rebuttal. 5 minutes.
Thank you, Justice.
Quickly, Justices, going back to the one satisfaction rule, the opposing counsel made attempted to make a distinction between liquidated damages and damages awarded by the jury based on testimony at trial. One's contractual nature, one's based on the evidence that's presented. However, the cases regarding the one satisfaction rule don't make that distinction. The cases regarding the one satisfaction rule clearly say that where there's one injury, doesn't matter if there's an injury that has damages that are contractual in nature or not, you have to elect a remedy. They failed to elect a remedy. The proper procedure at this point with respect to the one satisfaction rule would be for the court to remand for election of remedy or for the court to elect a remedy for them. The other thing to consider here, Justices, with respect to the tortious interference, is that there hadn't been a payment on this house in over a year. It had already been proposed for foreclosure 5 times at that point and ultimately was foreclosed on the 7th posting. Essentially what's going on here is that Mr. Pack is wanting my client to compensate him for his repeated irresponsibility in not making his mortgage payments. He continued not making his mortgage payments after the Funks withdrew, after the sale of the house to my clients did not go through. With respect to the breach of contract, Justices, the evidence presented at trial was fairly clear that there was two different contracts here. There was a contract for the purchase of the home and there was a temporary lease. My client, Mr. Glenn, paid extra to move into this house, I believe on March 31st. And the evidence presented at trial shows that Mr. Pack failed to move out. It wasn't until, I believe, 10 o'clock at night, which is what the testimony shows, that he was even close to getting ready to move out of that house. And the evidence presented by his own real estate agent shows that he barricaded himself in his room, that he didn't have his things packed yet, and that he wasn't ready to get out of there.
Now, is it true it was after 5 o'clock the previous day, and before there was arrival of what was supposed to be delivered to him, and so he canceled the movers?
It was right after 5 o'clock, but either way, the testimony presented, Justice, shows that he didn't have anything packed. He still didn't have anything packed, and regardless if movers were there or not early in the morning, the movers wouldn't have been able to move anything out because there wasn't anything packed, and he barricaded himself in his room. In other words, the testimony presented at trial shows that Mr. Pack didn't make any attempt during that day to move out. The testimony presented by his own real estate agent shows that he locked himself away and wouldn't come out and wouldn't even talk to his own real estate agent.
Did the Glens seek damages for breach of the pre-closing lease agreement?
At trial, that was part of the breach of contract claim that we had. We were not awarded damages, Your Honor. With respect to the Funks, again, the only testimony here that would have been able to clear up or to controvert what their own attorney said with respect to why they withdrew from the sale of the home would be to have the Funks called. The Funks showed up at trial. Mrs. Funk was there. However, she was never called. Why opposing counsel chose not to call her is not for me to surmise, but she was there. She was not called. With respect to the damages, as to, you know, subtracting numbers to get to a certain point and sort of inferring as to what the jury meant to do when awarding $50,000 and $194,000, if we want to go that route, Justices, the jury also awarded zero in attorney's fees for Mr. Yale, opposing counsel, and that was based on his request at trial that they award what they thought was fair and reasonable, and they did. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Mr. Vargas. Mr. Yale, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is now submitted, and you are excused. We will adjourn court.